We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
The roots are the G-N-O words, which means to do with knowledge. They're both negative on knowledge. It's what you don't know. So they're both similar in that regard, but the differences are even far greater. Because if I'm ignorant of something, well, I don't know about it, possibly because I can't know about it, possibly because I've just never had an opportunity to find out about it or hear about it. So you are basically ignorant of my mother's maiden name. I can't imagine many of you are staying awake at night worrying about the fact that you're ignorant about my mother's maiden name, but it's just a piece of information that where would you find out anyway, and why would you want to find out, and you're just ignorant of it. But being ignorant means that you're innocent. No one can hold you guilty for not knowing that kind of piece of information about which you couldn't know, or there's no reason to know. But that's where the difference between ignorance and ignoring lies. For we say that ignorance is no excuse before the law. What we really mean is ignoring is no excuse before the law. If you're ignorant because you had no earthly way of ever finding out, you didn't even know there was a question to answer, you weren't expected or required to know the answer, well then that is every excuse. You're completely innocent. But if you ignored the law, if there was a chance for you to find out and you purposely chose not to find out, well then you are guilty, because ignoring is refusing to look or refusing to accept the information that is readily available. It's not I don't know, it's I don't want to know. Ignoring is morally culpable. Now, why would people ignore information? Well, for lots of reasons. You ignore information because it's unpleasant, or because it's costly, because it's going to challenge you to change and you don't particularly like change or want to change, because it's socially unacceptable, because the culture that we're in doesn't want it, or because the peer group that you're moving with wouldn't want that piece of information. There's all kinds of reasons why people ignore. Some will ignore people in the street because they don't like them. There's a couple of people around this university who don't like me, haven't liked me for about 20 years now, and they always ignore me. When I see them in the street, they literally see me and walk across to the other side of the road and walk down the other side of the road rather than come anywhere near me. I always say hello to them. They always walk straight through me, past me, as if I hadn't said anything. They've done that for nearly 20 years now. I caught one the other day on Vassar Steps. He was coming up around the corner, I was coming in the corner, we virtually bumped into each other. I said, oh, hello. He said, hello, and then he realised what he had done and stiffened up and kind of went on his way. It was a minor victory in my two decades of campaign to be a person. Now, he ignores me and she ignores me. They ignore me because I am an unpleasant person. They are the kind of person that they would not want to know. And it is a choice to treat me as a non-person, because it is unpleasant to come to know me. Many other people find it unpleasant also, but they don't choose to ignore me. People ignore facts about themselves. People sometimes told they've got cancer and they just screen is the technical term. They say, oh, doctor, I thank you. I knew it wasn't cancer. And the doctor actually just said, no, you do have cancer, but they cannot accept that piece of information, and so they ignore it. Even at a subconscious psychological level, that plays tricks with the minds at this point, because we cannot accept the piece of information about ourselves. There are socially unacceptable pieces. You've been watching the athletics and the swimming lately, the swimming in the Pan Pacific and the athletics in the World Championship. Because if you have, there's a fascinating piece of information that you may or may not have noticed, and if you do notice, you don't quite know what to do with it because it's socially unacceptable to acknowledge it. That is, in the swimming pool, hardly anybody who is in any of the finals is an African. And in the world champion, or an American African, black, we'll call it black. And in the athletics, hardly anybody in any of the sprints especially are white. You notice that? You come down to the 100 metres run, they're all black. And they're not New Zealanders either. All of them, every one of them. Now, why should it be so? Because swimming is a more expensive sport than running? Well, I mean, you can think of all kinds of social reasons. Why do you want to think of social reasons? Because the idea that there could be a genetic racial difference is something that is socially unacceptable. And I'm glad it's socially unacceptable, because racism and the evil hand of racism has dominated so many hundred years of society, and we don't want racial distinctions to be made whereby people are given different socioeconomic rights. And we don't want racism, but in our desire to do away with racism, it now becomes almost impossible for us to acknowledge that there could be any racial differences at all, even though you look at the 100 metres in the Olympics in Atlanta and remember, there won't be any white men running in, there won't be any white women running in the 100 or the 200. That's an extraordinary thing. And you watch in the swimming pool and you won't see the Africans swimming. Could it be? Now, I'm not saying it is. Please don't say it is, because then you'll all write letters into Theranga saying, don't go to campus Bible study, the man's a racist. See, it's socially unacceptable, so I didn't say. I'm just asking the question. You say, even asking the question is a racist thing. You see, we don't like certain pieces of information, and so it's easier to ignore them. Just don't pay any attention to that, because it doesn't fit in our framework. I invited a man, a senior scientist, who was so senior he'd given up science, just was running the government departments of science. Asked him to a Christian meeting. He said, no, I wouldn't come. I said, well, why won't you come? Hear about the gospel of Jesus. He said, I wouldn't come because if I came and I was persuaded it was true, I'd have to give up too many things. Interesting approach to life, isn't it? There is a purposeful, intentional, open and above board ignoring. I do not want to find out, lest it challenges me to change. At the other end of the spectrum, I spoke to a PMG linesman some years ago, a man desperately in tears, really big, bulking man, but crying, and he kept on saying, I know it's true, but I could never face the mates at work and tell them that I was a Christian. So it's easier to ignore it, have nothing more to do with it. As far as I know, that's what he's done. Now, how do you go about ignoring things? Well, there's lots of ways to do it. One of the ways, of course, just avoid it. Don't read, don't discuss, never come to a Bible study when you're invited. And obviously, you people have not taken that course of action because you're at least here. But there are other ways of ignoring, aren't there? You can come and then just go to sleep. That's a way of ignoring. You just intentionally close down, right, and think out the kind of calculus problems you should have been working out this morning. And so, I mean, those people don't know I'm being rude about them now because they're not listening, are they? So it's quite all right. I can be as rude as like. Don't laugh too much or they'll say, what I miss, what I miss. So just leave them in their somnolence. And there's ways of ignoring, aren't they? You can just change the subject, can't you? You can just, as people talk about Jesus, just say, yeah, well, I used to go to church. My grandfather, he was a minister. And then off you go on a family tree and you don't actually talk about the subject that's been raised, namely Jesus. There's any number of ways in how to ignore. But Jesus makes claims and acts in such a way as to call upon people, force people to make decisions. Look at chapter 9 of John's Gospel, which we're looking at chapter 9 this week, verse 39. Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, so that the blind will see and those who see will become blind. He comes to bring decision, to force decision, to open the eyes of the blind and to close the eyes of the sighted. And this chapter, he is making such claims, but the chapter is basically about people's response. John's Gospel is about people's response to the claims of Jesus as they deal with this extraordinary man. And so as we look at this chapter and the claims of it, it's particularly the responses that we're going to be looking at. And you'll see we've given you today a response card, and I'd just mention it now so you can start filling it in en route on the way through, because we also need to check up on our role, see who's now missing from campus Bible study first session so we can write them a reminder letter, see that you're still with us is very helpful, see those who have joined us during the beginning of the year and not on our role, so if everybody could fill it in, it's a great help. But you'll notice down there, there are boxes down the bottom. I want to investigate Christianity further is one of the options that people have. For we're inviting people to investigate further, and especially if you've come from the kind of background where you haven't had much chance of hearing about the gospel. You come from an Arabic background or a Vietnamese background. You may come from a Christian Arabic background and indeed know much, but we have groups in lots of different languages and subcultures, and we're happy to help anybody who wants to investigate further. So you might like to tick that if you would like to investigate further, but let's look at the claims here in chapter 9. It all kicks off with a miracle. The miracle of the man who was born blind being healed. Verses 6 and 7. Having said this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with saliva and put it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. The curing of congenital blindness. For some of us, that's no difficulty. That God could cure somebody like that. Well, God is God. He can do anything he wishes. For others, they say, yes, well, I can believe it, but I'd like to know the mechanism that was involved. I mean, was there something special about the water of Siloam? Was there something special about the saliva? Was there something special about the dirt? Was there something special about this kind of blindness? Is it a psychosomatic kind of cure that we're dealing with? What kind of cure is it? Congenital blindness is one of the hardest of diseases to cure psychologically, because it's one of the hardest diseases to develop psychologically. For why would a baby psychologically come to blindness? It nearly is always a physiological one, and therefore your psychosomatic healings are rare in the congenital blindness categories. Peptic ulcers, very big. Bad backs, super big. Long legs, yes, they can pull your leg any time, but congenital blindness is one of those ones that faith healers find very great difficulty with, because it's not psychosomatic, whatever else it may be. And therefore there are some who will say, no, look, it couldn't happen. You know, I can believe that Jesus had such magnetic personality that he may overwhelm someone with peptic ulcers so that they get better. Because that kind of thing, well, 60-70% get better on placebo. So certainly they could get better on Jesus. That's easy. Just the ultimate placebo. But congenital blindness, it doesn't happen. These miracles can't happen. Now, especially for those who want to think like that, let me just give a couple of quick points. One, Jesus' contemporaries did not deny his miraculous powers. We've got contemporary evidence about Jesus from those who are for him and those who are against him. And for the first 200 or 300 years, people write for and against Jesus. Quite bitter attacks on Jesus and Christianity you can read in the ancient world. But nobody ever challenges that he did the miracles. People will say, oh, he did the miracles because of evil powers, because he was demon-possessed, but they don't deny that he did miracles. That's the first problem that you have. Second problem is, you must not rule out a priori anything happening. For history is replete of people who have said, oh, that cannot happen. Those kinds of things cannot take place. And the scientific mind is not a closed mind. If you're doing it because you think science would never allow such a thing, you haven't understood the scientific process of thinking. The scientific process is not closed mind. Scientific process is to say anything is possible. We've got to investigate to find out. To say it off, though, by saying it couldn't happen is to close your mind from the beginning. That was a funny one that came out a couple of years ago in England. There were a group of theologians who said the virgin birth could not happen and therefore it did not happen. And at much the same time, the doctors had implanted a virgin with an egg that had been had conceived, and so actually she produced a child. So there was this 40-year-old virgin woman who produced a child thanks to medical science. At the same time, as theologians were saying, God couldn't do what the doctors are now able to do. You mustn't start off by saying it cannot happen. It can happen. We humans can make a virgin birth happen. If we humans can make a virgin birth happen, how much more the God of all the universe could make a virgin birth happen? But if you have the closed mind, which is really the willful rejection of God, because we've got to ask the question, what's the motivation behind such a closed mind? It's really a desire to ignore God. If you've got the closed mind which says miracles cannot happen, well then you see the problem. You really are not working on a scientific mind, and a priori you can't rule it out. Third thing you would say about this miracle is it doesn't prove that God exists. That Jesus did this does not prove that God exists. And to add to it, John's Gospel and Jesus did not use miracles or record miracles for the purpose of proving the existence of God. That is, most of the debates about miracles that you find in philosophical textbooks are a subsection of the existence of God. The New Testament never uses miracles to prove the existence of God, to debate out that issue. They're using miracles for a completely different reason, that is, the fulfillment of Old Testament scriptures to point out to who Jesus is, the one sent from God to fulfill a certain mission. It's not actually on the philosophical issue as to whether miracles do or do not happen, or whether God does or doesn't exist, but rather the symbolism of the miracle is what is important. That is, they're called in John's Gospel not miracles, they're called signs. And the important thing about a sign is what it signifies. And what does this sign, the man born blind, now healed, what does it symbolize? You can trace it through John's Gospel frequently the miracles occur in order to point to something far greater. That is, Jesus refuses to do party tricks. He refuses to do miracles. People come to him and say, show us a miracle that we may believe. And he says, a wicked and adulterous generation want miracles. He won't do them. And yet he goes around and does them. Because the ones he does, and especially the ones John records, are recorded because they are significant of something else. They are symbolic of something else. They're not recorded so as that you will say, now I know God exists. They're recorded so that you will know, well, let's look at John 9 and see what it is. For what it's about in the interpretation of the miracle is light. Jesus is claiming in verse 5 of chapter 9 to be the light of the world. It's picking up what was said at the halfway through chapter 8, verse 12 rather, of chapter 8. He said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Now this is being explained in chapter 9. He, verse 5, while I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. Light can be used to symbolise knowledge as opposed to darkness, ignorance, or good as opposed to darkness, evil, but most commonly in John's Gospel it symbolises life as opposed to death, sight as opposed to blindness. For here is a man living in darkness. He lives under the physical disadvantage of blindness, which is obvious enough, but there is a symbolic disadvantage to blindness as well that's not all that hard to grasp. For ponder his state in Israel. He is excluded from all the ceremonies at the temple because blind people are not allowed to go to the temple. Only those with sight are allowed to go to the temple. So he's excluded from that, and therefore he's excluded from the full religious life of Israel, which was fundamentally a religious community. He's impoverished in life. You can see in verse 8, he's become a beggar, for there is no place for the blind in the ancient world except for that of begging. And thirdly, you'll see that he is viewed as a sinner and an outcast, not only by the Jewish eldership, etc., but also by the apostles of Jesus. Look at verse 1. As Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth, verse 2. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? For anyone who is blind is clearly a sinner under the judgment of God, in their view. And here is a man who is blind and therefore clearly under the judgment of God as a sinner. Only trouble is, he was born blind. So what is it? Did he sin in his mother's womb? Or were his parents sin and he's being paid for that? What is the view of the blind man? Not the view that he has, the view that people have of him, but as the outcast of God, under the judgment of God, cut off from the temple where he could find forgiveness. Cursed by God. That is the perception. You see it there in verse 34 with the Jewish leaders saying the same kind of thing. To this they replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? You see, the man born in blind is the man who is the profound sinner. He is the symbol of the judgment of God. He lives in the darkness of death as an outcast from the people of God. And to this man, Jesus gives sight. You see how the parable, the event, is not got to do with proving the existence of God so as to satisfy religious philosophy classes. It's got to do with the people of God having the judgment of God in amongst them, and this man being symbolic of the outcast, the sinner. and profoundly steeped in sin, for he's even been born that way as an outcast. But the sight he receives is more than physical sight. It's spiritual sight and spiritual perception as well. For the spiritual blindness and spiritual sight is what the passage is about. His physical blindness just raises the much bigger issue of people's spiritual blindness. And most of the chapter is about their spiritual blindness. The physical blindness is dealt with in just two quick verses. It really is relatively unimportant. It just raises this bigger issue of spiritual sight and spiritual blindness. And thus in the end of the chapter, Jesus talks of blindness and of sight. And he says at the end of the chapter, chapter 9, verse 39, Jesus said, "For judgment I've come into the world, so the blind will see, and those who will see will become blind." The Pharisees who were with him heard him say this, and they asked, "What, are we blind too?" And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin, but now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." He's not talking about physical blindness at this point. He's not talking about physical sight at this point. He's talking about spiritual blindness. And the Pharisees are so blind they cannot see that he's talking about spiritual blindness. They are so blind they think he's still talking about physical blindness. For us to miss the point is even worse, isn't it? That is, Jesus brings judgment. He brings a crisis of judgment, of decision. And to those who are blind, he offers sight. But to those who see or think they can see, he brings blindness. It's quite an extraordinary the way Jesus does things. The way that the real Jesus, I mean not the way in the manger kind of Jesus, not the Jesus, gentle Jesus, meek and mild kind of Jesus, not the Jesus in stained glass windows with big dinner plate behind head kind of Jesus. That the real Jesus brings division. The real Jesus forces decision. The real Jesus confronts you with judgment. Your judgment of him and his judgment of you as you meet with him at any point, even in the printed words that we have here. For wherever he is talked of, even to today, he divides the audience. For some, he is the light of life. He is like blind people seeing. He's like sleepers awakening. He is like the dawn of a new day. He's like the dead coming to life. But others, it's all stupid. It's nuts. It's mad. It's crazy. They won't have anything to do with him. It just doesn't make sense. Why are you going on about a Jew who was killed 2,000 years ago? I mean, nice bloke, said some clever things, but then there's lots of nice blokes who have said clever things down the centuries. What's so special about this one that you would make such a fuss about it for so long afterwards? It depends on your perception and on your blindness. For look into chapter 9 and all the decisions here today are there in the first century. There are those who are ignorant of him, who just don't know. The man born blind, he just didn't know who Jesus was. He was sitting there begging, and then people start discussing why was he blind, was it God cursing him or his parents or whatever it is, and then suddenly this man tells him to go and wash, and he goes and washes and he sees, but he doesn't know what he's about. He doesn't know who he is. I mean, he knows his name. But that's about all. So verse 11, the man replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes, and he told me to go to Siloam and wash, so I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked. "I don't know," he said. He's not a follower of Jesus. He doesn't know Jesus. He doesn't know what the teachings of Jesus are about. He didn't know him. Verse 25, he replied, "Whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, and now I can see. That's what I know. And knowing that, I know God's on his side." Verse 32, "Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. So given the fact that I was born blind, I can now see, and he's the man who did it, I reckon God's on his side." He really knows very little about Jesus. He doesn't know who he is or what he has come to do. And the crowds don't know. They're pretty confused too. Verse 8. His neighbours and those who were formerly seeing him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that he was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him." But the man himself said, "I am the man." They said, "Well, then how then were your eyes open?" they demanded. He replied, "The man Jesus who made..." So they don't know. They don't understand. It's a classic little piece. The Bible's full of beautiful little pieces of historical authenticity. The fact that they don't know the man born blind is a piece of just true-to-life reality. You walk in the same gate at university every day. You walk past the same grey person every day. Would you recognise him down the street in your home suburb? My guess is no. Most people treat functionaries as functionaries, not as people. They don't notice who it is. You just walk past. I hope as Christians and those who are Christians here that you do more than that. You say hello and you do get to know them. But most people treat functionaries just as functionaries. They don't know what they really look like. I think that's the man. I'm not sure whether that's the man or not. He's exactly right. That's how people are with beggars. You see a beggar, you ignore them, don't you? You don't go over and say, hello, how are you getting on today? Because you know what they want. They want your money. So as soon as you see a beggar, you turn your eyes away from them. When years later, this beggar stands up and says, oh, I was the beggar. You say, well, yeah, I think you look like him, but I can't remember anymore. Because I only ever saw you in your uniform, down by the corner, sitting there, yelling out. That's how you step out of that uniform, I don't know what you look like. I don't know you. It's not only they don't know Jesus, they don't know the beggar. Now that kind of, you can't, if you can, you can be a fiction writer and write that kind of thing, that's possible, but you're a very clever fiction writer if that's the case. But if you're a history writer and you're just recording what happened, that's exactly the kinds of things that happen when you ask people for information. Just get confused about this blind man. Anyway, they don't know, he doesn't know. The people don't know who Jesus is, and that's why even today we invite people to find out about Jesus, because we don't want people to be making decisions on the basis of ignorance. But in this chapter we also see people ignoring Jesus in lots of different ways. The Pharisees are the classic group, a subgroup within Judaism at the time, who ignore by inquiring. They inquire, but not to find out. They inquire, not to discover. They inquire in order to be able to ignore with a sense of self-righteousness. See, Jesus didn't fit in with their religious traditions. He healed the man on the wrong day of the week, verse 16. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he doesn't keep the Sabbath. Now, they're not sure about it. Others go on to say, well, how can a sinner do such marvellous things? So they're divided. Some see the ridiculousness of saying, well, it can't be from God because it's Saturday. I mean, a man who was born blind can now see because of the hand of not God on the Sabbath. But yet within their Pharisaic religion, keeping the rules and regulations rather than keeping the principles and the heart and the spirit of the rules and regulations has become a way of life. And they now strain out the gnat and swallow camels, because they can't see the point of the law, even of the Sabbath. It's still the case, friends, that people judge by backgrounds and by practices rather than by truth and obvious reality. Look down at verse 29, for example. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, well, we don't even know where he's come from. What does it matter where he's come from? Here's a man who has done something of which they've never heard before, nor much since. And they're saying, well, we don't know where he's come from. I mean, the other day, I was speaking to a friend, and he comes from an ethnic minority group in Australia. I will call it Italian for the sake of the discussion and the tape, and we don't think, right? So I will make this whole story into Italian, but I'm not saying that he's Italian. It's an ethnic minority group. He's become a Christian, and he was keen to run some Bible studies in Italian for Italians. And so he went to the local newspaper, Italian newspapers, and asked if he could put an advertisement in inviting Italians to come and have Bible study in Italian for them. But the local Italian newspapers would not publish his advertisement because he was not part of the Italian church, namely the Roman Catholic Church, in that case, if it's Italian. And because he was not a representative of the Roman Catholic Church, they would not accept any advertising to come and study the Bible in Italian. So he went to the ethnic radios, and the ethnic radio people would not take any advertisements or allow any ethnic shows, because if it's Italian, it's got to be Roman Catholic. If it's not Roman Catholic, it can't be Italian. And so you can't do it. Where you come from, which religious institution, whether he knows the truth or not is not the issue. It's a question of whether he fits in with the right system, whether he fits in with the right religion. That's still the case. There are still parents of students who will not like their students coming to Bible study, and you see students doing it too, same kind of thing. And so we invite people. We don't make much of the fact that I'm an Anglican, especially as most of our staff, or many of our staff, aren't Anglican. This is not particularly Anglican, but there are some people who say, oh, I won't come because it's Anglican. And there are others who say, I won't come because I'm not Anglican enough. As if it matters one way or another. I mean, it's a confusion of the label and the product, isn't it? Doesn't matter what the label is as to whether it's a Lowry honey or it's Eater honey. The question is it honey? That's the question, isn't it? But because it's got wrong labels on it, we say to people, you come to campus Bible study, they say, no thanks, I'm a Baptist. What's being a Baptist got to do with it? It's like saying, no thanks, I'm an engineer. You know, I mean, it's an absurdity. But yet, because of religious background, people will make their judgments without looking at the truth. The Pharisees also ignored him by historical cynicism. Verse 18 looks really good, actually. The Jews still do not believe that he had been born, still did not believe that he had been blind and received his sight until they sent for the parents, the man's parents. Is this your son, they asked? Is this the one who you say was born blind? How is it that he can now see? Now that's pretty good, you see. That's historical. That's saying, okay, he's a man. Maybe he's a different man. Let's find out if he is the man. I ask him, he says, no, I'm the man. But he could be part of the plot, couldn't he? Let's get his parents. Is this your son? Right? So to check it out is a good thing. And you can see the same kind of checking out taking place elsewhere. But they go on and on in their inquiry, endlessly asking the same questions. And look at the response of the blind man, who, remember, has now received spiritual sight. He's cleverer than they are now. He actually understands the game. Look at verse 26. Then they asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered, I've told you already and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? I mean, do you want to become one of his disciples too? Nice little barb at the end there. Because after a certain number of times the same question is asked, you realise that the person is not seeking the answer. After a certain time when people won't listen to the answer but then just keep coming back again and again, you realise they don't want to know what the truth is. They only want to know what they have already made their mind up. I mean, I'm glad that they checked the story. I'm glad because it demonstrates to modern readers that the ancient world were not just full of gullible miracle mongers who would believe any silly story that went around. They checked things out. There's a terrible arrogance of modern man to think that we are more intelligent than ancient humans. We're not. You read your Socrates, you read your Plato. They were just as clever as we are. Just as clever. And they didn't believe every story that took place. They checked it out. And they're checking this man out. And that's good. But you've got to check out for what purpose? Well, to find the truth must be the aim of the game. If it's not the aim of the game, then it's just cynicism. And cynicism never knows the truth. Cynicism always lives in ignorance because cynicism ignores the truth. I know the theories of scientific methodology. I know about Mr. Popper and I know about Mr. Kuhn, and I know that we've got to set up null hypotheses to disprove things because it is easier to disprove things than it is ever to prove things. But Mr. Popper wanted to disprove things in order that he might be able to confirm the evidences of the conclusions of life that he had. The aim was positive in the long run. It wasn't to disprove things so that we could come to the grand conclusion that we know nothing. That is not the aim of scientific inquiry. It is the aim of cynicism. To doubt and to doubt and to doubt and to doubt that you can even doubt. Ultimately, you know nothing that way. Or again, there's another way of ignoring, that is by censorship. The censorship enters in verse 22-23. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews. For already the Jews had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Christ would be put out of the synagogue. That's why his parents said, he's of age, ask him. You know when people start censoring, that you're getting close to the truth. For censorship is the activity of people who are worried. It's the activity of people who build their authority on power and authority rather than on truth. For if you build your life upon truth, you need never censor any other opinion. You can welcome any opinion, because if the opinion that comes is actually shows that what you are doing is wrong, then you're able to change and build your life on truth, which is what you want to do. But when you build your life on authority, on tradition, on background, on anything other than truth, then you cannot afford to have people just saying anything. You've got to stop them saying things, because somebody might say what will undermine your position. Now, it's a sign of great weakness when people want to censor. So, in Islamic countries today, there are places where we could not preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. The things that I've even been saying so far this day would not be allowed. Malaysia, many of you come from Malaysia. I'm not allowed to go to a Malayan in Malaysia and speak to the Malayan about the Lord Jesus Christ and his death and resurrection, and that he is the Lord of all, and that therefore Muhammad is not the true prophet of God. That would get me at least deported, if not put into prison for saying it. For those of you who are Malaysians as citizens, it would certainly wind you up in prison. Saudi Arabia, Middle Eastern countries like that, you're not allowed to run Bible studies like this inside university campuses or in the country at all in some countries. Or again, there are Marxist states where again you are not allowed to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. Anyone who would do such a thing can be facing long terms in prison. Now, Christians are not like that. Christians allow anybody to say anything. That's why we have so many lunatic people saying such lunatic things in especially the religious affairs department of the ABC and the Sydney Morning Herald. They are always going on with the latest lunatic theory as to why Jesus wasn't who he claimed to be. And 5 years later, they're discarded, but by that time, 10 others have risen up in their place. And we've got to welcome those lunatic ideas. I mean, there was a great one a few years back there about Jesus was part of a mushroom-sniffing community. They were all high on drugs. Now, a reputable academic, Professor Allegro, put forward the idea, and it was publicised through the ABC Religious Affairs Department, through the Sydney Morning Herald. Nobody, not even Mr. Allegro, now believes it. It was all the rage, sold thousands of books at the time. Now, that's all right. You see, because we stand on truth, we welcome anybody to put up any hypothesis to demonstrate that it is wrong. It takes a few years to work through and show why it is wrong from time to time, especially when they're weird and novel like that. But we must never censor people, for censorship is the sign of insecurity in the truth. And that is what this was happening. Communities in Sydney are still like it. You become a Christian and you run the possibility of exclusion from your families. We've had people from Muslims, from Marxist, from Jewish, from Buddhist, from Anglican, from Maronite families exclude their children, adult children, on the base of becoming Christian. Censorship is still alive and well. And that's a reason for ignoring. And fear goes, of course, with it, because that's the whole thing of it, isn't it? Verses 20, 21, you see, his parents were afraid. That's why they wouldn't speak up. Afraid of the dreadful ostracism from their own community. And so it's best not to know. I don't know. I mean, I know he's my son. I can't deny that. But I don't know who it is. I don't know what. Who asked him? I don't want to know anything about it. The fear of the consequences of friends, of employment, of risking employment when you've got to go and tell the truth in those interviews and the like, of careers. I knew a psychologist who I saw regularly, not for my own problems, but for his. There's nothing wrong with seeing a psychologist for your own problems, but I wasn't for his, it was for his. He knew that Christianity was true. And for 7 years, he refused to become a Christian. And when he did become a Christian, he told me that the reason was he was always afraid of what he would have to give up. And I said, now that you've become a Christian, have you had to give up much? He said, no. But for 7 years, he lived in the torment of knowing something was true, but not being able to do it. And the end of this chapter gives you the reason that lies behind most of these reasons. It's the one in verse 40, where they say, Verse 40, what? Are we blind too? The Pharisees ask. Some years ago we ran, as I mentioned last week, a campaign, No Christ, No Life. And the negative of it, N-O Christ, N-O Life, really got people angry. There was a philosophy lecturer who came and spoke at a debate for us, a non-Christian speaking against a Christian speaker, and he started off his speech by saying, before I enter into the topic, I want to say that I really disassociate myself from the program, the campaign called No Christ, No Life. I don't mind people claiming that they know life because they know Christ, but I am deeply offended and insulted by anybody saying that you don't have life if you don't have Christ, because they are saying that I don't have life just because I don't have Christ, and I take that as a matter of enormous arrogance, rudeness, impudence, and an insult to me that you are saying, went on and on and on about that. It's called pride, friends. For if what we're saying is wrong, show us where it's wrong. But if you don't know where it's wrong, then maybe ask the question, maybe I don't have life. Maybe they have got something. But the person who has to go around saying, you've got no right to say that, is the person who is showing their insecurity, isn't he? And he is showing his pride. I had a chaplain ring me up, a clergyman ringing me up, furious. Your students, they're always mine when they do the wrong thing. Your students have come here and they've told me they've been born again, and they've said they've been coming to my church for years, and they have, and they've never heard about this fact that you've got to be born again, and why didn't I teach them about being born again? And they even went so far as to suggest that I hadn't been born again. He went on and on and on. The impudence, arrogance, rudeness of young whippersnappers really went bizarre, and the whole thing went off. And he never asked the question, have I been born again? See, pride stands in the way. I know it all. Well, says Jesus, if you do, then that just means your guilt is even greater. Verse 41. If you were blind, well, you'd not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, in this chapter, John is about the judgment of Jesus. The blind and the sighted. The blind man who received his sight was found by Jesus in verse 35 and confronted with great gospel claims in verses 35 to 37. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Jesus says. Who is he, sir? The man replied. I tell you so that I may, tell me so that I may believe in him. The Son of Man is an Old Testament figure who rules the universe at the judgment day. Jesus said, you have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. The man said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. Notice the blasphemy of a Jewish man worshipping another Jewish man. It's a blasphemy for the man to do it, and it's a blasphemy for the man to accept it. Unless, of course, he is God. But everywhere else in the scriptures, when a man worships a man, he is cut down. When a man allows other people to worship him, he is cut down. But Jesus was worshipped by this man. For the physically blind had become spiritually sighted. Just as the physically sighted had become spiritually blind. So what action do we take? Well, if you're ignorant of Jesus Christ, find out more. Tick the box you want to investigate further. We'll get in contact with you and talk about it. Come again to Campus Bible Study. Pick up one of the books that we have outside. But if you are ignoring Jesus, then stop it. Now, if you're ignoring Jesus, you now need to go and find out more. Well, I've just told you what to do. But there are people here, I guess, who will be ignoring Jesus because they know it's true, like the psychologist for 7 years, but just don't want to face up to it. What do you do? What do you do when you find it's true? On the back of the outline, down the bottom of the outline, you'll find the prayer there. I'm going to pray at the end in a few moments' time. And you'll notice in the first paragraph there that the guilt that you need to be forgiven of includes ignoring God. That you thank God for sending his son that you might be forgiven and raised again to give you new life, and that you pray that God will change you as well as to forgive you. That's the kind of prayer you need to pray to become a Christian. That's the kind of prayer I'm going to pray now. Let's pray. And if you know it's true, but have been ignoring and running away from God for years, then why don't you join me in this prayer, just in the quietness of your own mind, as I pray out loud. Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be accepted by you. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you. I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your son to die for me that I may be forgiven. And thank you that he rose from the dead to give me new life. Please forgive me. change me, that I may live with Jesus as my ruler. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.